A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. And yes, we are talking with Harmeet Dhillon, the head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division and the Second Amendment Section, Assistant Attorney General. You know, originally supposed to talk with the Assistant AG yesterday morning. Had a bit of a scheduling conflict. I'm actually glad that we did. Because early yesterday afternoon, the DOJ announces that it has filed a lawsuit against the Metropolitan Police Department of Washington, D.C. over the District of Columbia's ban on so-called assault weapons. And I don't know that we would have been able to talk about that with Harmeet Dhillon had we did the interview at our normal, regularly scheduled time. But we were able to address that lawsuit as well as the litigation against the U.S. Virgin Islands over its gun control statutes and more. Very pleased that the Assistant AG could spend some time with us, and hopefully we'll get a chance to do this again in the new year. But without any further ado, take a look and a listen. Madam Assistant Attorney General, thank you so much for coming on the program today. It's good to talk with you.
Yes, thanks for having me today, Cam.
Absolutely. And there is a lot to talk about, but I want to get started with the brand new lawsuit filed by the Second Amendment Section against the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C., challenging the district's ban on so-called assault weapons, because this really is a historic first. This is the first time that the DOJ has actively litigated against a gun ban. I know that you've participated in oral arguments against Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons, but this is the first time the DOJ has taken the lead in litigation here on this issue.
Yes, you're right. And we're very proud to be leading that effort. I'm a proud gun owner myself, and we care deeply about the Second Amendment here. And here in the district, you know, I've gone through the process of registering my firearms that I brought from California when I took this job. So I've, you know, gone to the desk there in the Mary and Barry building and done all the paperwork. And I find it to be very frustrating that where really the birthplace of the modern movement to bring back the focus and the liberties under the Second Amendment is right here in D.C., as you know, in 2008, the Heller case. A police officer, a special police officer, had to sue the district over these very fundamental issues of the right to possess arms here in the district. And yet, after all these years of litigation, after the Bruin case, which made it very clear that you know, the district needed to promptly issue CCW permits, which they do, to be fair, they're still clinging to this outmoded definition of what firearms are permitted for law-abiding citizens. And I think we are aiming to bring this issue squarely back to the D.C. Circuit, if necessary, or to the Supreme Court, and perhaps use this case as one of the many cases that are percolating up in the courts to make it definitively clear that, for example, AR-15s and other popular semi-automatic rifles are protected by the Second Amendment.
Absolutely. And as you say, there are a number of other cases that are percolating already in the legal system. In fact, the Supreme Court has a challenge to Cook County, Illinois' gun ban that's sort of pending in conference. I think you've noted in the past that right now we don't have a circuit court split on the issue of bans on these commonly owned firearms. It sure looks like maybe the Third Circuit it might provide us with that split just based on some of the questions that we heard in oral arguments in a case challenging New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines. But the DOJ actively litigated on this. It really seems to me like this is, I don't want to say if nothing else, but this is certainly, among other things, a strong signal to the Supreme Court that the Trump administration and the Department of Justice believes that it is time to take up this issue.
You're absolutely correct. And, you know, from remarks made in opinions or concurrences, dissents by Justice Thomas over the years, you know, he's clearly signaled, and I think he's going to be joined by an increasing number of justices on this so-called assault weapons issue, that the most commonly possessed rifles in the United States, under longstanding Supreme Court jurisprudence and analysis, are protected by the Second Amendment. So jurisdictions that refuse to honor that are violating the civil rights of American citizens. And like it or not, you know, people who live here in the district, I'm one of them, we're American citizens, and we have the same rights as the people who live in the red jurisdictions, which do not ban these popular weapons.
That's absolutely right. And we've heard, I mean, you know, some courts of appeals have said, well, these armors aren't even protected by the Second Amendment, right? They're like machine guns. They're unusually dangerous. They keep coming up with all of these tests that of their own device, right, their own devising, in order to uphold these bans, instead of looking at what the Supreme Court has actually said about the arms that are protected by the Second Amendment.
Right. And when you look at those Supreme Court precedents, they in turn dig back to the founding principles and what was considered to be a law-abiding citizen, what was considered to be a weapon in common usage. And we don't believe that the Second Amendment rights are tied to being in a militia, of course. But when you look at what were the weapons people were expected, law-abiding, able-bodied men were expected to pick up and take into a militia, they were weapons in common usage, not unusual weapons, strange weapons, exotic weapons, cannons, for example, but weapons in common usage to do lawful things. They're the ones that were picked up and used. And so today, these semi-automatic rifles certainly fall into that category. And the outright ban on them in the district is at odds with precedent. And we look forward to litigating this case.
I'm looking forward to it as well. I'm also looking forward to the DOJ's litigation of the U.S. Virgin Islands lawsuit, because I got to tell you, I did not have the U.S. Virgin Islands on my Second Amendment section bingo card as one of the first pieces of litigation. But reading that complaint, holy cow. I mean, this is crazy, right? So you've got the delays in issuing permits, right? A year or more in many cases. So that's a problem right there. But then the Virgin Islands also demands that anybody who does obtain a permit has to have a particular kind of safe. They got to have it bolted to the wall. And then they've got to let the police in without a warrant to inspect that safe and make sure that guns are being stored securely. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's blatantly unconstitutional in multiple regards. And again, what we're making the point here is no American left behind. You know, maybe a far-flung destination, D.C., Virgin Islands, these are territories and not even states. But citizens have rights here. And I think in a way, some of the police departments in some of these jurisdictions have just gotten away with it because people think, oh, there's not enough people there. Who cares? It's not really a core, you know, American jurisdiction. But it is a core American jurisdiction. The principle is an American principle. Now, putting it at the other end of the spectrum, we've also gone after Los Angeles County, perhaps the most populous county in the United States, for 3-year delays in processing and granting these CCW permits. That's outrageous. And justice delayed is justice denied. I will say, and to be fair to the District of Columbia here, I was a little skeptical, but I walked in and I got my CCW in 6 days here. That's what the law requires. And these unreasonable delays are unconstitutional. And so what we're finding in some of these jurisdictions is that they're making the excuse, we don't have enough people to process the paperwork. Well, now, let me give you an example. Imagine that you were applying for a parade permit in Los Angeles, a Black Lives Matter permit, for example. And the city hall said, well, we'll give you the permit response in 3 years.
Right.
I mean, that is insane, right? You're having a parade next week. So it's actually the same kind of a right. It's a core constitutional right. And waiting that long is simply impermissible. So they need to staff up, just like the parade offices, permits offices are staffed up, because it's a violation of the First Amendment to not process those promptly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, if this is a problem that goes back to the LA County Board of Supervisors for not funding the Sheriff's Department and their licensing division, all right, fine. But you're right. They've still got an obligation under the law to ensure that people can exercise their rights. And, you know, talking about these three lawsuits, if you can, talk to me a little bit about the decision-making process within the Second Amendment section about what lawsuits to file and where, because obviously this is a target-rich environment, right? I mean, you've got Santa Clara County charging over $1,000 to apply for a concealed carry permit. New York PD, same thing with the, you know, year-long delays. So there are a lot of places for the Second Amendment section to go in and try to clean up. How do you decide what cases you're going to take?
Well, I'm not going to give you the secret sauce of our decision making, because that would be that's privilege. But let me give you the big picture of my philosophy as a plaintiff's lawyer, which is you can't necessarily go after every jurisdiction. You want to pick the cases that allow you to make the point in court that then become the precedent that other courts and jurisdictions have to apply. So it's kind of test cases, it's what impact litigation type of an analysis. The second thing is, honestly, if I had the resources, I'd go after more jurisdictions. We are going after more jurisdictions. We've filed just a couple of lawsuits in 2 weeks, and there are going to be several more that come as we roll these out. We have other work that we do here at the DOJ, but we are pretty understaffed. And as you can imagine, some of the career staff here aren't jumping up and down to implement Second Amendment litigation. In fact, some of them are quite critical of it. Members of Congress don't like that we're doing this. So we are, you know, sort of having volunteers in the Civil Rights Division step up to help with this work. And many people are very passionate about it. I have several former members of the military, many gun owners have stepped up to join us here at the DOJ. But we actually need a lot more lawyers here in the Civil Rights Division to do all of the work that we do. That would free up more of our resources to do this work.
Are you hiring Second Amendment attorneys right now?
We are hiring in general, and certainly people who care about the Second Amendment are more than welcome to apply.
Okay. And as for those critics who say, you know, the Civil Rights Division shouldn't be defending the Second Amendment, I mean, listen, just go back and read the congressional debates over the ratification of the 14th Amendment, the right of freed slaves to keep and bear arms. Read American history, right? And the subjection that these freed slaves had to go through where they were deprived of their right to keep and bear arms. And now we see some of these very same laws being used to defend modern day gun control statutes. So, yes, our civil rights are definitely implicated when we're unable to exercise our right to keep and bear arms. All right, you might not be able to answer this question too. I might be asking another secret sauce question, but you know, I don't want to get into the big debate over DOJ's position on NFA items. That's a topic. I'd love to have you back for an entire show to talk about that. But you know, we are seeing, for instance, the president signed last week an executive order aimed at speeding up the reclassification of marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. That's going to have an implication in you know, ongoing court cases. When it's not necessarily the Civil Rights Division, but, you know, other U.S. attorneys or the Solicitor General and their cases deal with the right to keep and bear arms. Is the Civil Rights Division involved in any discussions about how the DOJ is going to approach these issues?
Well, we may on a case by case basis. I think you certainly are not seeing U.S. attorneys' offices going out of their way to you know, pick up cases that are, you know, out of bounds within the meaning of what a lot of Second Amendment activists think is the law. But, you know, there are cases that the DOJ was defending, not, and I don't defend them. It's usually the Civil Division or the Solicitor General's office that is defending these cases. We do talk to those folks, and, you know, I know there's frustration, but I think people should stay tuned for changes coming to ATF and, you know, new personnel and all kinds of things. It does take time to turn a giant ship of state around. And you have to understand that 100% pretty much, or 97 or 98% of the lawyers in the Civil Rights Division were, I don't know if any of them owned guns. They certainly were opposed to, you know, the type of gun rights we're talking about here on this show right now. And we turned that around. I mean, I hope people are pleasantly surprised at the zeal with which we are pursuing this new section and this important right. I'm really proud of it. And there are a lot of people here in the building who fully support it. You know, I will be speaking at some gun events next year. And, you know, I have, this is the last day of Hanukkah today. And when we're filming this, and I met with a rabbi last week, an Orthodox rabbi here in the DOJ, talking about all the hate crime work that we're doing to protect Jewish houses of worship. And something I tell these Jewish groups is, arm yourselves. It may not be something that you're used to, but it is the moral duty of every person to defend their home and defend their liberty and their life. And we are unique in the world, in the United States, to be able to do that. Those poor folks who were gunned down in Bondi Beach in Australia, they didn't have that right. People don't have that right in the UK, where synagogues are under attack and where churches and other houses of worship are under attack. We have that right in America, and people need to be exercising. And I say that to my own faith community and the Sikh community as well. And so I think this is such an important right. It isn't philosophical. We have a crime wave going on in this country thanks to the open border in the prior administration. And you can either protect your castle or you know, put yourself at risk. So I think this is a very real question that we are stepping up to the plate to defend. And just give us time. You're going to see action in many of the jurisdictions you mentioned, and even some red jurisdictions where they have unreasonable restrictions. And so by the end of this administration, you will see substantially more liberty in the Second Amendment area than people imagined was possible.
I like the sound of that. And I got to say, you know, you are absolutely right. We're not talking about hypotheticals here, right? This isn't about how many angels can fit on the head of a pin or how many AR-15s can fit on the head of a pin here, right? When you talk to that rabbi, I don't know where he lives, but again, you know, rabbis in Los Angeles, they might want to take your advice and get armed, and they'll find out if they can 3 years later, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Real people are being impacted by these laws that you're challenging.
There are synagogues under attack in Beverly Hills and on the Upper East Side of New York. And it's getting real, okay? And and churches are under attack in this country. I have more hate crime prosecutions involving attacks on churches and decapitations of the Virgin Mary and so forth. Like, these are real things happening in our country. And I think that people need to understand that it's really our right and our duty to protect ourselves.
But I get the sense, too, that this is personal for you, too. I mean, you've talked about your own gun ownership. What is it like to actually be leading the charge as the DOJ actively takes on gun control laws for the first time in the Civil Rights Division's history?
Well, it's an honor, honestly. And it's something that I feel is necessary in our country today. And our rights don't defend themselves. And if citizens don't stand up to protect our rights, be they the First Amendment, Second Amendment, I love the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment also. I'm a longtime civil rights lawyer. And, I don't think this is a conservative or liberal issue. I think this is a human rights issue. It's a natural law issue. And the founders were very wise to provide for these protections. And the assertion of them as a civil right affirmatively protected by our federal government is long overdue.
Absolutely. Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. It's been a real pleasure. And I hope we get a chance to do this again in the new year.
I hope so, too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas.
You too. I really do appreciate Harmy Dillon joining us on the program. And hopefully we will be able to talk with her again going forward. I don't know if I'll get a response, but I plan on reaching out to the Solicitor General, Dijon Sauer, and maybe that's where we can talk about the Trump administration's position in some cases that has perplexed, confused, and angered some Second Amendment advocates, right? The defense of the NFA is one thing, but even, you know, upholding or arguing that bans on switchblades are constitutional, that switchblades are not protected items under the Second Amendment. There are some positions that the DOJ is taking that rightfully concern Second Amendment advocates. At the same time, the DOJ Civil Rights Division and the Second Amendment section is truly doing historic work to defend our Second Amendment. Both of those statements are true. And again, we will continue to cover what the DOJ is doing. Both those efforts that will get a round of applause from Second Amendment advocates and those that generate some consternation among defenders of our right to keep and bear arms. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a story out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte Observer wondering, how did the man accused of murdering Frazier Baker get out of prison after he previously shot a man? And the answer in this case is problems with the trial, apparently. Lorenza Inman Jr., charged with murdering his girlfriend, Frazier Baker, earlier this month. But the Observer says he has a long criminal history that included three prior assaults and a shooting. He has cycled through jail for years, has been convicted of more than 10 crimes. His rap sheet dates back to 2005. And he was convicted of attempted first-degree murder in 2017. But the state appeals court overturned that conviction, and prosecutors in Mecklenburg County, rather than retry the case, offered Inman a plea deal. As the Observer writes, 4 months after that deal, freedom from prison, police charged him with punching a woman in the face. Then almost 5 years later, they charged him with shooting 31-year-old Frazier Baker to death and leaving her body in a car in a West Charlotte parking lot. Right now, he's being held in jail without bond. At a February 2019 trial in the non-fatal shooting of another man, jurors in Mecklenburg County found that Inman was guilty of attempted first-degree murder, possessing a gun as a felon, and assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury. Prosecutors persuaded the jury, convinced the jury that beyond a reasonable doubt that he followed a man named Sharif Pope to a shopping center in April of 2017, confronted him, shot him in the chest, then fired several more rounds at him once he hit the ground. He was sentenced to 13 to 17 years in prison, but when Inman appealed that decision, the conviction was tossed out by the state's court of appeals in December of 2020, with the judges ruling that the trial judge in this case had erred when he allowed prosecutors to use a written statement from the victim, Sharif Pope, as well as an audio recording of police interviewing him. Originally, apparently, Pope had declined to testify, but after the judge ordered him to take the stand, he did so. But I guess that was after the police interview and the written statement were introduced. Appeals Judge Donna Stroud wrote in a December 2020 opinion, saying that the trial court erred by admitting an out-of-court statement by the victim when the victim was available to testify and did, in fact, testify, adding that Inman was entitled to a new trial. But rather than take him to trial again, in March of 2021, the Mecklenburg County DA's office allowed Inman to take an Alford plea. Basically, you admit that there's enough evidence to convict you, but you maintain your innocence on both the assault and gun charges. As part of that deal, prosecutors dropped attempted first-degree murder, attempted robbery with a dangerous weapon, and discharging a firearm in city limits. And he was sentenced to time served. So he was let out days after he took that deal. Now, here's the thing. It was 2019, right, when he was originally convicted. And then in December 2020, the appeals court said, nah, he needs a new trial. And then in March of 2021, it was February of 2019. And then in March of 2021, he was given that plea deal and he got out of jail, right? So he basically served 2 years for assault, possession of a firearm as a convicted felon. And that's a problem because that's a really light sentence just for those crimes, right? And look, we've talked a lot about the prohibited person statutes here on Bearing Arms, Gam & Company, right? You've got challenges to 922G3, the unlawful drug users forbidden from possessing firearms, 922G1, anybody convicted of a crime punishable by more than a year in prison, prohibited from owning a firearm, even if it's a nonviolent offense. Inman has a long history of violent offenses, right? His previous convictions aren't for jaywalking. He was charged with possessing, selling, or buying something with an altered serial number 2006, according to the Charlotte Observer, I'm guessing a firearm, as well as possessing up to a half ounce of marijuana. That's basically the only nonviolent offense that he's been convicted of. He was convicted of assaulting a female, possessing drug paraphernalia in 2007, assaulting a government employer official in 2008, simple assault, carrying a concealed firearm and possessing marijuana with intent to sell or distribute it in 2014. And then just 4 months after he got out of prison in July of 2021, he went back for a parole violation after he was charged with punching a woman in the face. He was scheduled for another trial on misdemeanor charges of assault inflicting serious injury, but the woman dropped her complaint. She wrote in an affidavit that she would not attend court. She would drop all charges and restraining orders, that it was all just a, quote, misunderstanding. According to another arrest warrant from August of 2021, though, the day that Inman was arrested, he called that woman from jail, threatened her, and then asked that she get him out. So he was actually charged with threatening the woman and once again was able to take an Alford plea to intimidating a witness as well as habitual misdemeanor assault this past October. Just a few months before his girlfriend was killed. And he was sentenced to 24 months of supervised probation. Again, another inexplicable decision. You know, when we talk about sweetheart plea deals, one of the few justifiable reasons why prosecutors might offer a deal just to get something on the books is when a witness refuses to cooperate. And when witnesses are intimidated into not cooperating, the criminal justice system needs to take that very seriously, because it undercuts the entire basis of our criminal justice system. If people are afraid to testify, how can justice ever be done? So the fact that Superior Court Judge Louis Trosh sentenced Inman to 2 years probation for intimidating a witness who he allegedly assaulted, I mean, to me, that's even more egregious than the appeals court reversing his attempted murder conviction. But the bottom line is that the man who is accused of murdering Frazia Baker could have and should have been behind bars had the criminal justice system in North Carolina taken his previous crime seriously. That's it. That's the bottom line. Inman was the recipient of at least two sweetheart plea deals that did not need to happen. There was enough evidence, particularly about intimidating a witness, to take that case to trial. Even if there was not enough evidence to obtain another conviction on attempted murder, and it sounds like there was, these deals that allowed him to skate on these criminal charges. I mean, someone's already lost their life because of it. I think people should lose their job because of it as well. But that's just my opinion. On to today's armed citizen story. From Ohio, the Cleveland area, where a road rage shooting has been deemed self-defense. What makes this a little bit interesting is that the assailant in this case, 79 years old, the defendant, the armed citizen in this case, 25 years old. And so at first glance, you might think, well, I mean, come on, what's the 25-year-old left to worry about a 79-year-old man, right? I don't know. I mean, it sounds like the prosecutors made the right call to me. This was earlier this year. Cars pulling in, you know, pulling off of a main road, kind of pulling into a parking lot. There's another car that's kind of pulling out of a little side street and basically cuts off the car that's pulling in. The guy that was pulling in is a 25-year-old. And he said he honked when the other car cut him off. The driver of the other car, a 79-year-old man, throws his car in park, gets out, and starts yelling to the 25-year-old, I'm going to cut your head off. I'm going to bleeping kill you. The 25-year-old said he started reaching into his pockets and everything like that. He's just literally grabbing, reaching into my window. So I hurried up, I grabbed my gun, and I shot. The 79-year-old was wounded but was not killed. He told an officer at the hospital that he was being treated, he said, I'm a bleep. He said, I get out of the car and I'm old. And I said to him, I'm going to cut your head off. And he said, get back in your car. And right quick, there was a 9mm in my face. There was surveillance video as well as a witness. And after police finished their investigation, they sent the case on to prosecutors. Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office issued a statement saying it was determined that the state of Ohio would not have been able to meet our burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the 25-year-old male who had the presumption of self-defense was not acting in self-defense. The armed citizen told police at the scene, he said, you know, I've got four kids. He said, I'm not trying to cause trouble. I'm not trying to do nothing. I feared for my life, you know? And I get it. I get it. I mean, this guy, again, all he did was honk his horn at somebody who had cut him off. The other driver gets out of the car, goes up to the driver's side window, starts fumbling around like he's getting ready to pull something out of his pockets while he's screaming, I'm going to bleeping cut your head off. I'm going to kill you. At that point, I think you have a reasonable fear that your life is in danger. And again, I know I've said this umpteen times before. If that 79-year-old man is simply driven off after being honked at, mumbling to himself, I can't believe that guy honked at me. No. Would have been forgotten 3 minutes later, 5 minutes later. Completely forgotten. And instead, he's lucky he's not facing charges, quite frankly. Also lucky to be alive today. And again, I know I don't have to tell you this, but, you know, when you see somebody acting like a jackrabbit on the road, just let it go. Let it go. because there is no telling what an escalation can lead to. And even if you act in self-defense, again, there's still going to be a police investigation. There may still very well be charges filed. It's just, again, I hate these situations because they are so easily avoidable. But the road rager in this case essentially guaranteed that a gun was going to be pulled when he started threatening the other man's life. Finally, today we have our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, when able to do the right thing. A police officer in Michigan who saved an unresponsive one-year-old child. Mom says the boy had been ill recently, had stopped breathing. Matt Vergadamo was in the area when the emergency call was placed Wednesday afternoon. This was last Wednesday, about 5:30. Vergadamo is a evidence technician officer with the Metro Detroit Police Department. He got to the home about a minute after the 911 call was made. He found the unresponsive child, whose name was Roman, being held by his mom, who told him he's not breathing. Vergadamo turned the boy over, administered several blows to the back, right? If you're dealing with an infant, you can't do the Heimlich maneuver, so you got to kind of, you know, swat the back. Within seconds, Roman coughed up whatever was blocking his airway and started breathing again and crying, which has got to be a wonderful sound to hear when you are a mom who is, you know, panicking about a child who's not breathing. Medics arrived from the Sterling Heights Fire Department. They provided advanced medical care that took Roman to the hospital for further treatment. Two other officers responded to the scene. They remained with the family's other child until the dad arrived at the house so that the family was supported. Sterling Heights Police Chief Andy Satterfield praising Matt Vergadamo, saying that his response represents policing at its very best. His ability to arrive quickly, remain composed, and immediately take life-saving action quite literally made the difference between life and death for this child. We're incredibly proud of his professionalism, training, and dedication to serving this community. So, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Matt Vergadamo, we appreciate your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I do want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. Tomorrow's Christmas Eve. We are going to have a show for you, though. In fact, we're going to be talking with Mike Cedini from Walk the Talk America. Not only about what the group has done this year, its accomplishments, but, you know, it's the holiday season. This can be a stressful, it could be a sad time for a lot of folks. This is going to be my first Christmas without Miss E. And so I do want to talk about mental health, and I want to talk about what we can do as gun owners to support each other during what may be a difficult time for some of us. So we'll be talking about that with Mike Cedini on tomorrow's program. Hope you have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. I will think I'm scheduled to be on Newsmax tonight in the 6 p.m. Eastern hour. So be sure to tune in for that. And we'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.